Meandering as a research method invents paths. It entails moments resting, pauses, then taking up the volume of the activity again. It involves hesitations, contradictions, ambivalences, and provisional conclusions. Meandering is walking without a pre-made map. Instead, we are creating the map while mapping out the paths, while formulating, fabulating, provisional conclusions. Worlding as a practice can only partially frame what is ahead. Yet, we can imagine, speculate, and create necessary fictions. Meandering as research creates a temporality where constantly becoming with the act of walking creates an oscillation of partially perceived frames, which results in a kind of fractional knowledge that we accept with its uneven rhythm, where knowing is at times a fleeting gesture. Through meandering, the landscape emerges and the landscape acts back on us. Many people are walking with us, have been walking, are creating paths simultaneously, have created paths before us. Meandering as research is responsive to these paths of people that accompanied us and whose voices we have heard. And yet, meandering as research creates an inherent temporality and rhythm and rhythm and rhythm and rhythm. And rhythm.
Breathing, writing. Writing a word carries with it an exhalation. Writing a word anticipates the exhale. I write a word for it to be read. Sometimes I read the word out loud, taste the word when I write it, and hope that someone else might read it also. Writing contains exhaling. Writing and breathing are linked through rhythm. Rhythm precedes meaning, Meshunik. When rhythm comes before meaning, grammar structure needs to be rethought, redone. There is, after all, the question of the body, the human body to be more precise, that we tackle through this phase of the research. A body that we'd like to think in its materiality. We also play with the concern for physiology when referring to Tufnell's account of the diaphragm. Through that we hint to an image of a body that is caught in the architectural concern of human skeleton, and its connections with organs, fluids, etc. Yet we feel kinship with gender studies scholar Magdalena Gorska when she challenges the universalizing approach of physiology, and instead she advocates the constitutiveness of differentiation as part of the body process described. Such an understanding is crucial in order to not essentialize the human body, but instead conceive and think and do it as one materiality next to many other materialities. In order to still hint to the specifically human bodily materiality, Gorska picks up the notion of corpomateriality developed by Nina Lücke. And from there, Goska thinks corpo-affectivity in order to address the entanglement of bodily materiality and affect.
Hey! Hey! Ho! Ho! Hey! Hey! Ho! Ho!
According to evolutionary theorist and biologist Lynn Margulis, evolution does not correspond to the figure of a tree model, but of a web. Life from its very beginning was interconnected in a symbiotic act that at times generates fusions and forms we would not have imagined in the first place. Thinking in Earth as symbiosis between living organisms is a critique to so-called anthropocentrism and individualism. The very reproducibility of our body depends on food that is edible, on air that is breathable, and soil that is not fully toxified. We as human animals, taking into account all the differences and inequalities that exist, we need to understand ourselves as radical relational, radical interdependent.
Then take your hands and place them on your face, your fingertips, and just feel all the detail of your face, moving your fingertips over all the contours and caves and cliffs of your face. Soften your eyes and look ahead and also around.
Feel the palm of your hand, how it is touching the fabric of the shirt you're wearing today.
It is challenging to speak about breath, even when being aware of breathing itself when speaking. It is also challenging to write about breath, even when being aware of breathing itself when writing. It is in general challenging to find language for addressing breath. Using verbal language to tackle breathing, IU run into the arms of the metaphors. Metaphors are open images. But they are not universal, but metaphors, like images, emerge from specific situations and experiences.
There are days when I can sit down and be with my breath, my body, my thoughts and my sensations, and receive them in all their complexity and detail. At the same time, sensing myself, a figure in the space of my room, inside the space outside my room, inside my history, my present and my future, everything all at once. When this happens, a movement appears, a movement that is in me but not me. Something like the consistency of air when two magnets repel each other. A slow movement that sometimes begins in my upper chest and my right shoulder. A honey-like magnetic sensation, seemingly moving of its own accord. Once I followed this movement, and it became a sort of uneven figure of eight and descended down into my ribcage. That day my attention was soft enough not to want anything and attentive enough to stick to the task. And slowly, slowly the sensation moved its way down into my stomach and pelvis, into my upper legs and knees and calves and feet. And then it kept going on, and the slow weaving thickness descended into the floor and then came back up my legs and back to my stomach and chest, and it moved into my head, and it felt as if my brain was made of a network of tiny worm-eaten pathways, and that the thick movingness came and washed over all of this material of the brain, resembling a kind of hard, porous kind of stone, like pumice, for example. And this hard brain softened and transformed, becoming a trillion tiny thread-like antennae, waving like grass in a substance something between water and wind. And then it went through me and around me, like a swarm of birds, changing shape constantly, thickening and thinning, pausing and swelling, then racing in convolutions.